UFP, the United Federation of Podcasts.
Welcome to Franchise Fatigue, the United Federation of Podcasts, little podcast devoted to movies, sequels, remakes, and all those little wonderful things that we love as fans. We keep going to the theaters, we keep spending our money, because we want to see the same stories over and over, because we just love it. And we love talking about it. I'm your nerd host, Brandon Shea Mutella, and joining me, as always, is the undead Zach Moore.
George is a good kitty!
I hate cats.
I do too. I don't hate cats. I just like dogs more. That's just all I have to say about that.
That's all you have to say about that. Tonight, we are talking about the 2019 remake of Pet Sematary. And we are so thrilled because we were able to make our schedules work and have our returning guest, John Mills, who's been with us for the last two, to come back and talk about the new one. I'm so happy you're here, John. Thank you so much for joining us.
I'm happy to be here just to represent people who do love cats. Because I do.
Do you have a cat?
No, not anymore, because when we got the dog, we still had the cat, and the dog tried to eat the cat, and then they had to live separately until the cat passed on. The cat did not pass on because of the dog, mind you, but, you know, I wish I could have just a separate house full of cats, which I suppose is a psychologically disturbing image, but there you go. That's me.
Awesome.
To be fair, I've never owned a cat, so I've had friends that tell me once you have a good cat, it really changes your opinion. So I've just been a dog guy my whole life with my family. So to be fair to all the cats and the cat lovers out there, I've never owned a cat. I'm sure if I did, I would find it cuddly and lovely, and if it died, I would try to resurrect it in a pet cemetery.
Yeah, it makes sense.
I'm allergic to cats, so that's why I don't like them. But anywho. Okay, well, we're not talking about my allergies. We're going to be talking about the Pet Sematary movie. But before we get into the discussion of the film, Zach Moore, tell me you found some trivia.
I did find some trivia. Now, this is a little different because this is a brand new film, right? I mean, it's all these other films that they've been documented for years and people have been writing books and articles and interviews and all that kinds of stuff. Lots of behind the scenes insight. This is fresh off the printer here, Pet Sematary 2019. So a little shorter trivia section than usual. But we still got some tidbits for y'all.
So what you're telling me is you didn't do your job fully.
No. Spoilers here, people. All right? If you haven't seen Pet Sematary 2019, go see it. Because a lot of this trivia is talking about changes made between the two films and the book. And that's really going to affect your viewing experience. So I wish the trailer companies held that same.
Yeah, I was just going to say, you don't even need to see the movie. Just watch the trailer and you'll be okay for the rest of the episode.
Mm-hmm.
Well, let's get into it, though. What we do have are some interesting insights from Stephen King. He'd actually proposed an alternate ending where Gage is walking up in the middle of the road and the sun is coming up, dawn is approaching, and a truck is coming, and you think, quote, oh my God, he's going to get greased in the road. That's how this is going to end, unquote. Stephen King said that. But then at the last second, a woman pulls him out of the road, rescues him, and says, quote, where's your mommy and daddy? And that's how you end the thing, but that isn't what they show. So that's what Stephen King said about the ending. And speaking of the ending, there were multiple versions of the ending that were written, and more than one of them was shot. And one of them was the original ending of the book, which is also more or less the original ending from the 1989 film. And they showed both endings to test audiences, and the new ending got the best response. So producer Lorenzo de Bonaventura said, quote, a lot of times with endings, you kind of just let the audience tell you what they're feeling. We got to screen both of them to people, and it would just seem like audiences really responded to that one. So that's why we got the ending we did. Now, we'll get on the endings. We're working backwards with the trivia here. But according to screenwriter Jeff Bueller, there were three different ideas, and they were ranked in order of darkness, and they picked the darkest one. And Jeff Bueller said it gave the film an extra punch. Quote, it felt right to have an ending that had a little punch to it, It was kind of a wink, like, we're in a horror movie, people. It's Friday night. You're out with your friends. Have some fun. So that's their logic of the ending they chose. And obviously, we'll talk about all the changes and whatnot that were made here for this film. And there are two directors for this film, Kevin Kolch and Dennis Widmeyer. And their approach was just finding a different angle. They didn't want to change stuff just for the sake of change, but they wanted to put a fresh spin on things. And they said, quote, when you're making an adaptation, you want to do as much new, fresh things that you can, because there's already an existing movie. But at the same time, you want to make sure you're staying true to the essence of the book, so that people still feel like they're getting Stephen King's Pet Sematary. And I agree. I think that's the right angle to take. And as we talk about it here in our conversation, it is well constructed. The changes they make, they think them through backwards and forwards and how it affects the overall plot. Now, they also go on to say, quote, it wasn't necessarily an idea like we have to change the ending. It was just sort of other things changed within the movie. We changed it from Gage to Ellie. Then obviously Ellie, then being this character that could now have the awareness to know what's going on with her and have conversations about it, it changed the scenes afterward. And that's true, because you know, Gage being 2 years old, there's really not a lot of self-awareness. There's existentialism, whatever you want to call it. But when Ellie, I mean, that's a chilling scene, and we'll talk about it, but when she is, you know, back from the dead, and she says, I'm dead, aren't I? Like, that's that stuff you didn't get before. So it takes you down a new road, which you didn't see before. But it, again, one of the kids died, so it's not a radical change. But speaking of death changes, Zelda's death changed from the original movie and original story. And director Kolch said it was changed based on a news story that Widmeyer had read about. And Kolch said, quote, the idea of dying that way was just so horrendous to me that we said, you know what? What if we try to do more with this? This still chills me when I think about it. And speaking of death changes, Zelda's death changed from the original movie, including the dumbwaiter. And part of the inspiration for this change was a news story that Kolch and Widmeyer had read about a waitress who fell into a dumbwaiter and broke her neck during her first week on the job. So I assume that she just wasn't familiar with how it operated, or you know, just wasn't, I don't know, terrible story, right? But they said, quote, the idea of dying that way was just so horrendous to me that we said, you know what? What if we tried to do more with this? This still chills me when I think about it. That's Widmeyer's quote there. So that is a change, because in the original, she just kind of choked. There was no dumbwaiter involved, but that became kind of a set piece of this film, as we'll talk about. Now, there were some concerns about Zelda, because this is interesting, bit of trivia to me, because back in our episode about the first Pet Sematary, 1989's, I had said if I was going to remake this story, I would probably just drop the Zelda character entirely, because it just seemed like a little much and a little necessary. They considered that as well, but only because it was done so well. And this is what Widmeyer had to say, quote, we were a little worried about the character of Zelda. There were ideas of possibly not doing Zelda because we were so in awe of the actor from the first movie. The complete opposite reason why I would have left it out, but that's what they chose to do. Now, during Ellie's birthday party, Judd can be heard in the background saying, quote, there was a big St. Bernard, he got rabies. And this, of course, is a reference to Cujo. There's also lots of other Stephen King references throughout the film. There is a D. Torrance realtor sign in one of the yards. That's obviously a reference to Danny Torrance. We see the Derry, Maine, 20 miles away in the exit when Rachel is coming back. So we see it on the road. So building the Stephen King cinematic universe and church, right? Church is the big, he's on all the posters, Church the Cat, right? So 5 cats played Church, and they were all rescues. So which I think that's great, because I do love, despite our jokes about cats and whatnot, I do love animals, and it's great they use rescue cats. And ultimately, one of them dropped out after getting scared on the set, but they were all accommodated in 5 trailers along with their human trainers. And another one had to be kept in a separate trailer from the others because it did not get along with a cat's mate. So that sounds more like a cat to me. Right, but animal trainer Melissa Millette said, quote, the only good working cat is a happy cat. They were quite spoiled. So I mean, yeah, like a whole trailer for a cat. The film crew even built an area near the trailers, and they called it a catio, where the hardworking cats could play and relax between takes. Now, these cats, they spent 2 months training for the shoot, which took around 10 weeks. And aside from the one cat that they got cranky, the rest got along well with each other. And all five cats found homes after the shoot was done. Two were adopted by the movie's animal coordinator, and Millette found homes for the other two with friends and kept one for herself. So that's always, we're joking about cats, I know, but I do love animals, and that's great to know that these cats, not only were they rescues, but they found a good home after the movie. So good on you, churches. And then finally, the end credits of the film. Of course, the 1989 film had Ramon's Pet Cemetery playing, and this version had the same song, but it was a cover by the band Star Crawler, who I've not heard of, but they sound a lot like the Ramones to me. I thought for a minute that was actually the same Ramones track. And then the last bit about the song, in the 1989 film, when the truck driver is going to hit Gage, there is a he's listening to this to a Ramones song, and this time he gets a text, but it's from the same name of the person in the Ramones song is the person who sends him a text message that distracts him, and the he almost hits Gage, and he goes off the side of the road, and of course he kills Ellie. So there you have it.
That's funny. I didn't catch that one.
No, neither did I. Neither That's did
funny. I. Okay, guys, let's jump into this discussion. Zach, thank you so much for your trivia. Okay, so the first thing we got to start with, I want to talk about the trailer. Okay, mm-hmm. So and I want to talk to you guys about spoilers in trailers, because I really wish that I didn't know this twist going into the movie. And I think a lot of people feel this way. And I know that there's a lot of critical analysis of trailers saying, oh, all the funny parts were in the trailer, or like everything is. And I know that the trailer is supposed to bring you into a movie, but I don't think that the twist of the change in plot is what's going to drive people to come to see this movie. Because Pet Sematary was so long ago, like 1989, that's, what is that? That's 30 years ago.
30 years.
Pet Sematary came out, right? That while I am a fan of the original, like, I'm not really their primary audience. Yes, it's Stephen King fans, but I think it's kind of like we've got this resurgence in horror films going on right now. And so I'm disappointed that I saw that. Did you guys, I know, Zach, did you know about the twist ahead of time? John, did you know about the twist ahead of time?
I had seen the trailer because people said, oh, here's the new Pet Sematary trailer, reveals something from the movie. I was like, well, I'm going to watch it. I'm curious to see it. And I was like, oh, well, okay. Thanks. You know, this is funny. You know, Jason Clarke stars as Mr. Creed here. He was also in another movie, a little movie called Terminator Genesis.
Amazing movie.
We'll get to that later this year. where they did a similar thing where they just kind of spoil a big thing in the movie, in the trailer. It's like, okay, I guess, I don't know why you put that in there. There's plenty of other things to put in the trailer. They totally did not need to reveal that they switched the kid's death. Because yeah. even and there's one scene, if you guys remember, when Ellie's asking her parents, are you going to be around forever and ever? And he's like, yeah, mommy and daddy and church are going to be around for a long time. And Ellie's like, in Gage? And like, oh, of course, Gage, you know? And you're like, oh, because the movie is set up to make you think Gage is going to die. And that's a big twist. And even and they do this, they set up certain things you know from the first movie, like when Judd gets his Achilles heel cut under the bed, and it doesn't happen. You're like, oh, okay, and then he jump scare you again later. So I don't know, like I don't know the logic of showing you that in the trailer, and I very much disagree with it.
I agree with you, Zach. I didn't have too negative a reaction. I consider it sort of a given that they're going to give away something key in the trailers now. I think that you have to have something that's like such a guaranteed hit, like an Avengers movie, where they can say, yeah, it doesn't really matter what we show you because you're going to show up no matter what we show you. You know, they could show a black screen where it's like Avengers released on April 25th. It's like, okay, people are going to show up. But I do think that this would have been a better trailer to set things up if they'd simply had Lithgow talking to Lewis, just to, you know, talking about that place has a, because I remember a voiceover started the first trailer I saw for Pet Sematary, where you hear Lithgow talking about that place is, you know, there's a power to it and all of this stuff. And, you know, sometimes dead is better, like a very targeted preview like that. I think that both the trailer marketing and the fact that they reveal stuff is actually just a byproduct of modern horror. Because Brandon, you mentioned the resurgence in horror. The way they market and execute horror films now is different. The genre has changed. Any genre does, but it's very much, I think, just a natural reflection. Like before this, of course, there were a ton of horror movie trailers when I saw it, and you know that there was the one for The Curse of La Llorona, and yes. Yeah,
I saw that one,
and you know, it's the same sort of trailer where it's, you know, okay, I kind of got the whole gist here of everything that's going to happen. Okay, that's cool.
Although while I was watching that trailer, I thought, I'm like, is this an Exorcist remake?
So, we could talk about that trailer at some other time. If there's a La Llorona franchise, we'll come back to that.
Okay, so we seem to be pretty disappointed with the way that the trailer went, and I know that I was, because like you just said, Zach, I don't mind movies that are remakes that decide to take it in a new direction. I like that. I think that's fun, because there are people who go to see these movies and then, you know, people complain. They're like, the original's better. And you know, like, this is why we're doing this podcast, is because we love remakes. I think that's a misstep that the company did by releasing that, because they were filming this movie and the plot of the movie was set up heavily to make you think Gage was going to die. You know, and while the ultimate story that they told could not have been done with Gage, because like you said, Zach, they were having these conversations about death. And that scene when Ellie's like, I'm dead, aren't I? Like, that was amazing. And I thought that was really cool and a really interesting way to change the story up. And like you said, playing with the audience's expectation who have seen the original of Judd flipping over the bed. You know, but again, that they. But I knew what was coming because they showed that attack in the trailer.
They showed it on the stairs in the trailer. They hit it twice.
They played with your expectations, but then they prepared you for it and ruined it in the trailer. And I'm really disappointed by that, because the movie was really well done. And I like, there are some things that I don't like about it that we'll talk about it, but I don't have a problem with a remake doing changes like this in general.
Well, I think that I would like to ask you guys, and I don't know if this is jumping ahead, spiraling a different area. I know, John, you had something to say, but what do you think about the change, period? Because I think it's interesting that they go into different story directions with it. Like you said, that scene where he's talking to her, and she's like, you want to stay with me? And he's like, yeah. And you can tell he's like really regretting his decision, and it's a real unsettling scene when he has to stay with her in a room after she's come back from the dead. But did they just not want to kill like a 2-year-old boy here in a 2019 movie? Because I mean, that's something I give the book and the original movie a lot of credit for, because that takes guts to do that, you know. And I don't know if that was a factor in their decision making. And then once they decided to make the change based off that opened up new story possibilities for him. Because you know, Ellie in the original movie, she just disappears. She goes off with the parents and she doesn't play a factor in the rest of the movie. And this way it does bring all the characters back together. So I don't know if that was a side effect of them coming up with a new angle to the story, or if they just kind of shied away from, again, killing a 2-year-old boy with a truck in the middle of a road, because that is a hardcore thing.
Well, I'll let John jump in. The only thing that I have to say on that is, to me, there's no difference between killing a 2-year-old boy and killing an 8-year-old girl. So, I don't know. John?
Yeah, I agree. I mean, Zach, to your point, I don't necessarily disagree with you. Like, I agree with both of you, right? Having a kid die on screen is a traumatic thing. Especially, you know, like post-parenthood, you know, that drag out that one that everybody knows. But like the weight of the, you know, of either child dying is equally impactful. But I do think that audiences are more sensitive to certain things now. So I would completely be willing to concede that this would be a reflection of modern sensibilities about storytelling, as opposed to anything. Because the thing is, the girl has also a higher level of just sort of like baseline intelligence and communication skills, so that when she does come back, I suppose that on subconscious level, audiences might buy into it more easily. They might be willing to go along with that because she already has the ability to speak very intelligently to her parents. And so when she comes back for that philosophical discussion with her dad after she's been resurrected or anything like that, it's easier, I think, for some audience members to buy that this kid is having, you know, these sort of realizations and this sort of intellectual angle to it.
Which they couldn't have done with Gage because he was too young.
Right, exactly.
Well, they've radically changed the story, right? Because, yes. Let's think about this. Like, the setup, right, of even Church dying, everybody's there. It's on Halloween. But in the original movie, it's on Thanksgiving when the family's away, you know? And then so that's there. And then he instead of, and you think, again, a misdirect, I'm like, oh, they're going to kill Church this early in the movie. He has the lethal injection thing like he does in the first film. But he doesn't do it, and he just lets him go on the road. And because he comes back, because they always come back, that's your old cat now. he's coming back on the road. and that's why Ellie goes out on the road. And so it's very well constructed. Okay.
Yes.
Like, I don't think it was a slapdash. Oh, let's change it up. Like they did it with intention. So I was just trying to figure out maybe what inspired that intention. But as we're all saying here, it's a different twist. It opens up new story possibilities. And that way it's not just a beat for beat remake. And as much as we like the first film, that's not what we came to see. If we're going to go see it again, just like the directors were saying, I want to see Stephen King's Pet Sematary, but I want to see a fresh coat of paint on it. And that's what they did. And I give them credit for incorporating that into the overall story. Not just like, it would have been really easy to just kind of switch one thing out and everything else plays out the same, but they didn't. And I give them credit for that.
Right, because, okay, so the one part that I had a really big problem with this movie because of the change, so I'll jump to it, is the final battle between the father and the daughter in the pet cemetery, where he's, like, choking the life out of this kid. Okay, now, I had a conversation with the friend that I went to see at the theater, and, like, I was kind of quiet when the movie was done, and I'm like, okay, I liked it. I didn't hate this movie. I liked it. But that ending in that battle sequence, like, really left me unsettled, because to me, the pain of the original movie is not there anymore, because when he chooses to kill Gage in the first movie, he puts him down like a pet. Right, which is a hard thing to do in and of itself, but it takes a decision, and he had to make that decision to kill Gage, and he had to walk up to his kid, and he had to inject his kid and put his kid to sleep again. Where this, he's fighting for his life because this girl is now trying to kill him. It takes that pain away. But then also, we've got this excruciatingly uncomfortable sequence of him murdering his child in a completely different way.
Yeah, well, I agree with you because the whole thing with Gage in the original, to your point about having to face this emotional trial of, you know, the injection and making that decision, it's still you can still very much see it as an act of mercy. Because if Gage were able to make a choice as to whether he wanted to come back as a murderous demon, most likely Gage would say, I'm not cool with this. And so it's an act of mercy. It comes across as an act of mercy. Whereas to your point about the fight in the pet, I completely agree, because you do remove the emotional element because, one, you've stripped any sense of the last vestiges of emotional attachment between father and daughter at that point. And it becomes just a fight scene.
Yeah.
And it's, you couldn't sit there and see, because, you know, the moment where she suddenly looks sweet again and says, daddy, please. No, you were just kicking my ass. No.
did anyone else think of Where No Man Has Gone Before when Kirk is fighting Mitchell?
Yes, that's what I thought of. Yes. So basically, it's a remake of Where No Man's Gone Before. Okay.
That works.
That's good. Yeah. That's a good call, Brandon. Because again, they've changed the story here. Because them setting up things that you expect from the first film, they don't happen. Like the wife says, "Don't bury me there," right? When she's about to die, and then the dad gets knocked out. And then you don't know what happened to the mom, but when the dad wakes up, daughter says, "Oh, she's already in the cemetery," and that spirals off into our new ending as well.
Right.
I want to say too that what I found with that was intentional or not, there was an echo of Pet Sematary 2 to that, because that's what Clancy Brown's mission became, to basically start creating his army of the undead by killing people and dragging them up there to bury them. And so I wasn't nuts about that because I didn't want to be reminded of Pet Sematary 2. So, you know.
Didn't you guys give that like a 3 or a 4? Oh, no, that was me.
That was you. That was you, Brandon.
Yes. Yeah, and again, I like that change. So, like, they're changing the story. That was different. I like the ending. I like the twist of you think he's going to decapitate the kid, and then his wife stabs him from behind. You know, I'm like, okay, I wasn't expecting that. That's kind of cool, right? And then they bury him, and then he comes back, and then they come back to get Gage. And I kind of liked the ending where the only thing, it cuts to black, and you just hear the alarm on the car. I kind of like that, right? What'd you guys think of that? Zach, we'll start with you on that one.
Well, it was unsettling. I mean, if they went through different endings, you know, that's the one they picked because it had the biggest impact. And I think it does because Gage... He's just as in the first one. That's why I was effective when he died. He was just this innocent little boy, and he's waiting, and you see like the zombie apocalypse coming toward him, and then Church jumps on the car like to accentuate the moment, and you're like, oh no, this poor little kid is going to get. They're going to kill him and turn into a zombie. Who knows what happens next? It's a different kind of ending though, because the first one it's kind of ambiguous. Because you're like, okay, she kills the guy, but what does she do next? I don't know, but it was unsettling, and I don't know if I like it better or worse than the first one, because the first one was a journey of a man continuing to make poor decisions, you know, and then like it culminates in like my wife just died, it might work better this time. And you're like, well, you know, if I were him, I'd probably be in the same boat, because at this point, you know, why not? I would have lost all sense of reality, but this really changes the focus. It's not his downward spiral of bad decision making that the first one is. So that, I guess that's my take on it.
I think that the ending starts to go a little bit wrong when he doesn't even make an attempt to drive away with Gage, and he just puts him in the car. I would have been better with them making a decision to have him get in the car and try to go away. But then you find out that Ellie slashed the tire or something something silly like that, where there's a reason he cannot leave with the kid, because at a baseline, any parent in any situation would be, okay, my job now is to protect this one and make sure that as many of us can survive as possible, and turn it, you know, maybe even into a foot chase at the end or something like that. We do know what happens afterward, because in the beginning opening shot, they show that car door open with blood going from the car into the doorway, and then it goes to white. So we do know
why
what
we
happened.
Started. I was wondering. I'm like, why do they start in media res like that? Like, why do they show us? Because you know, when they first start the movie, we can talk about this for a second, then we jump back, and we're jumping all around. But you start with this kind of, you know, helicopter shot of the town, and you see this house on fire, and I'm thinking like, oh. Maybe this is the flashback scene where they burn the guy's house because it take place in the past or whatever. And that's not what it was, because then we go into the Creed house and we see the station wagon and the door open. I completely forgot about that. I didn't wrap back around to think about that, John, because that's why that's there, because it kind of shows you what happened after. I was thinking, okay, why are they setting up the end? And I wasn't even in that place mentally. By the way, side note, as I mentioned in our podcast, that was my favorite scene, most unsettling scene in the first version. That's not even here at all. The flashback scene about the veteran, kid who got resurrected by his dad. Now it's in Creed's internet search, you know, and he's like, when it says Vietnam veteran missing from graveyard. So it's like kind of an Easter egg, if you will. But that was missing, and I was disappointed in that, because I thought that, you know, that's a really unsettling concept, and they could have done something a lot more with it in this remake, and they didn't do anything.
I completely forgot about that, John. So you saying that there was the car door was open. I remember the blood, but I don't remember the car door.
Yeah, the car door was open. Maybe you guys can help me out. I don't know why they went and burned Judd's house.
To get, well, in this version, yeah, I don't really know. In the previous one, I think it was just to get rid of the body, right? And, like, burn what was going on. But in this one, I didn't quite get why they did that. Because if she killed him, then why didn't she bury Jed and add him to the army, right?
Right, if that's her motivation after that.
Well, her
point.
Motivation now is to recreate their family unit. I mean, that she's like, we can all be together again. And as twisted as that is, that's what I understood her motivation to be. But to all be zombies, so.
Yeah, but... Well, I mean, the thing is, this is, I guess, where this dovetails into. I applaud any filmmaker that's going to take, make different choices and everything. But I think that this movie is undercut by a series of half measures, regardless of whether things were given away in the trailer or not. When Judd walks into that room and then kicks the bed aside and she's not under it, even if I hadn't seen the trailer, I know that is a big wink to the audience. Hey, if you saw the first one, we're going to do it differently, but we're still... Don't even send Judd into the bedroom, right? And I think that they did not handle I'm struggling with the name right now, but the student who dies in the beginning.
Pascal, right?
Yeah, Pascal.
100%, John. 100%. I agree with you.
I just didn't... And
they didn't utilize him as much as they did in the first one, so it's almost like, why is he there?
Exactly. Exactly. And I think that there was also the way that it's photographed, the colors are very washed out. And I get that they were trying to go for a very specific feel to things, but it really made me sleepy through most of it, because it was everything, like even the performances, and I understand the decision. I understand why they had understated performances at certain points, because it's supposed to convey this sort of, I'm in a living nightmare and I can't wake up feeling. But I missed any sort of spark. Now, the original has a whole bunch of B-movie charm and misfires of its own, but it does have that charm. And it has Fred Gwynn as, you know, he's the heart of that movie. This one, all of the performances are very muted, a lot like the color palette. And that, I think, was something that made it very difficult for me to connect with it.
Yeah, Fred Gwynn, still my favorite Judd. Now, I love John Lithgow as an actor. Like, he's one of my favorite actors. I love John Lithgow, but he's not as good here. He's not as good as Fred Gwynn, because Fred Gwynn, he had that, like, man, this guy, he knows something I don't know, and he, like, wants to tell me, right? But he's like, you know, it's just like there was something more going on there with Fred Gwynn and his whole relationship with him. And I feel like it just, I don't feel like it's a fact. Like, he had more scenes and more, you know, more dialogue, more monologues about things. Like, he built up the mythology of the Pet Sematary. There's even the scene where, like, is anyone buried a person up there? Oh, no, Christ on his throne, no, you know? And that builds up to the inevitable, like, he's going to go bury his kid there. Here, those scenes don't happen. And because they've restructured things, like, he doesn't save Gage from the truck, that doesn't even happen. He just comes across Ellie at the Pet Sematary. The housekeeper's not a factor anymore, which I agree with cutting that out, because that was kind of a dangling plot thread that didn't need to be there. But then there's not a funeral that he talks to Jeff. So there's just a series of scenes where you feel like you get to know this guy that weren't here. And so, in addition to just like the, I don't know what you want to call it, but the charm that Fred Gwynn brought to it, that kind of winkle in his eye, like that mischievous winkle in his eye, if you will, Lithgow is good, but he just seems like a beaten down old man, which is maybe what they were going for this time with Judd. But I much prefer the Fred Gwynn interpretation of the character and his performance.
Yep. See, I liked Lithgow. I thought he was just as good as Gwynn. I don't know. I enjoyed him. I enjoyed the added interaction that he had with Ellie, you know, and, you know, how he's this lonely old man and there's this little girl who's kind of got, like, no boundaries, who's, like, being his friend. You know, I kind of like that addition to the story that we didn't quite have as much of in the first one. And he says in this movie, you know, like, she got in my heart like nobody's done for a long time. And I bought that. I liked that a lot. So I'm okay with Lithgow in this, and I think he did just as good a job as Fred Gwynn.
Well, I don't dislike him, right?
No, you hate him.
But see, it's like Fred Gwynn as Judd in this is like William Shatner as the guy Nightmare in 20,000 Feet on the Twilight Zone. John Lithgow does a good job, but he can never be as good as the original incarnation. So.
Well, I'll say Gwynn's Judd couldn't exist in this film. I agree, and I think Lithgow is one of the higher points of praise I would have for the movie as a whole. I do like him, I think he brings a belief, an authenticity to the character. But I think that the core difference between the Judd in 1989 and the Judd in 2019 is the Judd in 1989, I don't know if it's just that sensibilities have changed, but I bought him as the town know-it-all.
He was
a walking history book of the town. Whereas Lithgow, even where they situate his house, he's set up more as crazy old hermit man. Whereas Judd in 1989 was more like the guy that people might try to politely avoid because they knew that every time they stopped, they'd have to talk to him for 30 minutes. And they didn't always have 30 minutes to talk to him. You know, that, and that I think that is the core of the charm that's, you know, for lack of a better word, that's missing there. But I do agree that Lithgow is one of the high points of the movie as a whole. So, you know,
I just wanted to see more of it. And this kind of ties into something else I want to bring up. This movie feel just fast to y'all. Like it felt like it just went because they took out these little subplots, like the parents, right? Like the whole like antagonistic relationship between Creed and his in-laws, gone. You know, the family traveling back and forth, gone. So it goes by very fast, and we got near the climax. And I was like, "Whoa, is this?" And it's really it's not that much shorter than the other one, just by a few minutes, really. But it feels shorter. It feels faster. You don't have enough time to get a flavor of the whole town and all that kind of stuff. And this version, did y'all get that vibe at all?
No, yeah. I don't know. I thought it was a good pace for this movie myself.
I did get that same sense, but what I didn't get that it was on fast forward so much as they made decisions behind the scenes or something of, we don't really need that. We can kind of skip over that. And as a result, I think that there's some connective tissue that it needed. Maybe it's missing Judd scenes that we're addressing here is where it goes wrong. Is like if there had been more of that and giving Lithgow more time to, you know, be on screen and be that guy and everything. And I just like the trailer, I think that this has a different horror movie sensibility, and it's one that I don't think works as well for this type of story because it's missing the sense of fun. Like the original has this appreciation of the absurdity of what it's telling you, and it goes full in on it, and it's I think I said this, you know, when we were talking about it before, you can almost feel like there's somebody sitting around a campfire telling you this story as a kid about this family that found an ancient burial ground and came back. Whereas this one is much more of a, it's almost like the same sort of disconnect I would feel with like a Zack Snyder DC movie, where it's like, it's so obsessed with being quote unquote real that it sacrifices any of its sense of absurdist fun.
That's an interesting take. I'll have to think on that one here because I don't know. Like I thought the pacing was good, and you know, like I really did like this version of the movie. There's a couple plot things that didn't quite work for me, but it didn't detract from my enjoyment of the film too much. So that's
well. If I may be positive for a minute here,
because please, yeah. That'd be a nice change.
So I liked Lewis and Rachel. I liked their relationship a lot more in this one. I liked the actors like Jason Clark and Amy Simmons. Mm-hmm. Do a lot better job than Denise Crosby and whoever that other guy was to play Lewis. Sorry, I don't remember his name from the first film.
Dale Midkiff.
There it is. How could I forget?
Even I didn't forget. Thanks for reminding me, John.
But they're not just the acting, but the way the scenes are written, their relationship. You know, he's, you know, just because of the way this version of the story is structured, he is honest with her about the pet cemetery. You know, he says, "We bury the cat." he buried Ellie, Belly comes home, that kind of stuff. Another thing spoiled in the trailer, like, hug your daughter, all that stuff. Like, that would have been good if we didn't know that the mom would see her as the zombie. Because if you remember the first film, Denise Crosby is Rachel just completely clueless about any of this, you know? She's rushing home and has no clue. So I liked Lewis and Rachel. I liked their relationship together, and I liked the acting they had in their scenes, especially Rachel. I think Amy Simmons did a great job elevating the character.
I'm on board with that. I absolutely agree that she did. I liked her take on Rachel. I thought it was, any time I come down and I say like the performances were too muted in certain scenes, I know that that's the director telling the actor what to do. In terms of the believability and the chemistry, I think it was there between the characters. Like, I believed in the relationship, and I believed that, you know, these were people that were a functional family that loved each other and existed. And I think that a large part of that has to do with the fact that they, you know, Lewis and Rachel have a less melodramatic existence in this version of the film.
I see what you mean. Yeah. I agree.
Yeah.
Okay, so I want to talk about one of the other elements in the film that I wasn't too keen on, and I don't know why they did it. So
I have to be so negative, Brandon. We're here saying good things about this movie.
Come on, man. Jeez.
So when Ellie's killing Judd, why did she morph into his wife?
I agree with you that it was out of place, but my takeaway was that the evil that sent her back did it to screw with Judd's mind. I mean, I would think it's traumatic enough that the undead have come back to claim you, but I don't know, because she had a throwaway line where I forget precisely what she said, but she says like, you're going to suffer for what you did.
Yeah. And
like an implication. Right. Which didn't make sense at all. Like, it was a complete, if there'd been a scene where like Judd was, you know, furtive about why his wife died or the type of relationship that they had, but everything up to that point is, you know, this is an old guy who desperately misses the misses and, you know, that sort of thing. And, yeah. So I think it was an odd choice. Yeah.
Yeah. See, what I thought, I don't know why they did it, but when they did it, I thought they were setting, as soon as I saw that, I thought they were setting up for another scare later on where Ellie was going to kill her mom and be Zelda.
Yeah.
As Zelda. Like, I thought that's what they were setting it up for. But even still, I don't understand why they were doing that. I don't understand, because that's some weird fantastical element. You know, and as we talk about in the Twilight Zone podcast all the time, like, you know, you have a movie and you have a fantastical element, and that's where your suspension of disbelief is because that's the story you're telling. Okay, we're telling a story about an area that can, like, bring dead people back. But having this second fantastical element is just weird and doesn't make any sense, and it really pulled me out of the film when it happened. I'm like, I don't understand why they did it. Maybe it'll become clear upon a rewatch, because, again, I've only seen it once. I saw it a few nights ago. I don't understand that choice.
They only had the one reference because there's the wedding picture, and he's like, "Is that your wife?" It's like, "What happened to her? She got sick. She died. That was it." And all it does is establish he's a lonely old man. It doesn't establish anything else, or it doesn't need to.
Yeah.
So it did feel you could really cut that out, and it wouldn't affect anything. Like, you have an evil zombie girl trying to kill you, and it was you know, him and Ellie had a relationship. You know, that's what makes it tougher than, you know, him and Gage in the first version, because he's, I mean, yeah, he's a cute kid, but him and Ellie are the ones with a connection, and to have him have to be the one to try and kill her with the gun and all that, that's a lot heavier.
Okay, so we might as well, we haven't talked about it yet. Let's talk about Zelda. Is there anything else we want to add about the Zelda plot line? Because again, even still, I don't know that it's necessary to the story. Maybe I'm just missing the heart of this, but even if the directors are saying we don't necessarily need it, I don't necessarily think that it's there, because they called back to it a lot more in this film than they did in the first one. But like, I didn't like how they switched up the death with Zelda, you know, with the dumb waiter. Like, I thought it was unnecessary, and it was just for a cheap scare, you know. So because when she chokes to death, like, that's a more believable thing for a young kid to think it's their fault rather than this person crawling down the dumb waiter and dying because they crawled into the dumb waiter or something. I don't know.
No, I agree. I think that the decision to have Zelda manifest by falling behind the bathroom mirror
What was that?
It was distracting, is what it was. And it was, and to have her hearing, like, it's almost like the movie was torn between whether it felt like there was enough scares in it. And so it wanted to introduce this idea of hearing the sister's ghost in this house, which turns it into a haunted house movie.
Yeah.
Which isn't this movie. It's not this story. Like, it would be different if the whole plot was the house itself is built on an ancient burial ground, and so the dead, you know, the fabric between reality is
The Shining
or something. But that's
The Shining.
Yeah.
The Shining.
Yeah, right? Yes. Correct. Absolutely. Yeah.
Zach, what'd you think?
Well, she wasn't played by a teenage boy this time. She's played by a teenage girl, so that was a plus. Mm-hmm. But I think, and again, it goes into them restructuring the story a bit. I did look, if they're going to use Zelda, I'm glad they expanded it a little bit because the first one, it just felt really, just really random, you know. And in this one, at least they kind of like space it out normally. I don't really have a preference one way or the other about like the way she died. But I do think they took out so much other stuff that they needed to supplement it with something. That's why we have that extended scene where the bathroom becomes the dumb waiter and things
that
of that nature.
Weird.
But to something you addressed earlier is instead of spending the time with that much of it and those extra jump scares and everything, that's more time you could have devoted to Judd or even Judd and Ellie. To reinforce that specific relationship would have rounded that out even more and, you know, made that feel more emotionally impactful.
Well, you know, in the original novel, Judd's wife is still alive and she, you know, eventually passes away. But early on, she has a heart attack. And then Lewis, being a doctor, helps her get over that. And that's why Judd feels indebted. He likes Ellie and stuff, but another reason why Judd feels indebted to help Lewis with Church when he gets killed, and that's a subplot that is not in either movie. And if they wanted to pad stuff out and then wrap back around to the wife, they could have done that as well. So there's plenty of it's a long book. There's plenty of material they could have used and not jump scares that could come out of The Conjuring.
You're telling me that a Stephen King book is long? That's crazy talk.
That's
not that long. And it's a quick read. It's actually a very quick read. I remember when I read it, I'm like, wow, I went through
this. Now, see, I've never read it, but I'm going to read it now because I'm legitimately curious because since there are two, you know, you got the two different versions and everything, I'm at least intrigued enough now, having gone through this whole journey with you guys. Now I want to read but I got to be a completist about it. I got to read it now is basically what it boils down to.
Zach, if you want to read it and I want to read it, maybe we could do a bonus content for the patrons and talk about the book.
Maybe we could.
I got to warn you, I'm a slow reader.
It's okay. I got a busy summer ahead of me. So,
well, sometimes the movie is better.
Sometimes the movie's better.
So. Nice.
So when we were talking about the first film, there was a point that I made and I said, I wonder how they're going to deal with this in a remake in 2019. And that was with the Indian burial ground. And they didn't really address it that much in the movie. They did, but they didn't talk about it as much as they did in the first one, which I thought was good because to me it was more culturally appropriate, but it's still like they still couldn't get around it. Like, I don't know how they could have just completely excised it, right? Maybe they could have invented something or even just not addressed it at all, because they even didn't even mention it until much later in the film. Like, when Judd's taking him up there, he's not saying it's an Indian burial ground when they're burying the cat, right? Mm-hmm. It's actually kind of a bit later that they start talking about, you know, the Indians and what they were doing in the art on the trees and stuff like that. So I wanted to talk about that too. Yeah, yes. And the Wendigo, I did want to talk about that a bit because we did mention it in the first one. I'm like, I'm wondering how they're going to deal with this in a 2019 environment. And so I don't know. I like the change. I thought it was good. I don't know if you guys have anything to add on the comment, because that was mostly me that wrote it up the first time.
I didn't really see it as too much of a change. The terminology might have changed a little bit, and they might have not you know, phrased it the same way, but it's still essentially the same thing. And it's, I mean, the thing is, stories like this have, you know, they've always been there. I think I said this in response to you last time, where it's like, it's always been this idea that the people that were there before you understood the land better, and they understood the magic that was in the world better. And there's still very much I think if you're going to keep it in, an even better thing to do, you know, when they remake it again in another 30 years is, you know, it's very much rooted in the idea of, you know, the technological advancement still cannot overcome the underlying forces that exist around you. And, you know, I think that I know through my whole life, there's always been this sort of spiritual respect for the native tribes as having understood the land better than the people who took it from them.
Now, like, I mean, as far as rewriting it, I mean, they could have simply replaced it. I'm not saying this is better. This is just something that came up at the top of my head while we're talking. But, I mean, like, it could have been something as simple as, like, an area where there was a radioactive spill.
That's a science fiction movie. That's not a horror movie.
No.
Alien's a science fiction movie.
Yes. Okay.
Should have done it. I'm not the writer. I didn't write the thing. I'm just saying that's something they could have done something else. Right.
Yes.
I'm just saying, I don't know what else they could have done. I don't write movies in Hollywood.
Alien. You're absolutely right. Alien is a science fiction horror movie, but this is
not a science fiction.
It's a horror. Like, you would so fundamentally change the core of everything about it. You know,
Brandon, that's like putting aliens in Indiana Jones. That is crazy. They would never do that.
You know, why you got to do this? Why you got to walk into that territory? Come on.
Well, the Indians, they knew that ground was sour. They stopped using that burial ground. See, that's all you needed. That's the Mark Twain.
Where's Data's head? Data's head?
Yeah. Guiding. But I agree with you, John. I don't think it was that big of a change. Maybe some terminology change. They didn't lean into it as heavily. There weren't enough Judd narrations and explanations and exposition speeches, so that's the only reason they don't talk about it as much. I mean, that's really all there is to it, in my opinion.
I'm just glad we didn't have some crazy rock morphing into some screaming face yelling at him in this movie. I'm okay with that.
that was odd. We never figured out what that was, did we, in the first movie? So,
yeah.
Well, a couple of final thoughts that I had, we can kind of go around, is I liked where they have the scene where they talk about death near the beginning of the movie, and then Rachel and Lewis are talking about it, and she's like, you really don't think there's anything after this? He's like, no, I don't. And understanding that being his worldview, you understand why he does what he does. Because he has no hope about the afterlife and the, you know, the family being reunited, that kind of stuff, the soul, nothing. His only worldview is this world, this tangible physical world. So that's why he does the links he does. Mm-hmm. Of course, that kind of, I thought, okay, that's why he tries the kid. That's why he'll eventually try to resurrect the wife. Of course, they swerve and they don't do that. but still, it still applies because that's why he goes to the things he does. And I thought that was a good, just kind of character insight that we didn't necessarily get, at least in the first movie. It might be in the book. I don't know. Did you guys catch the kind of, well, there are a lot of Shining references in this, but totally Shining when she kind of throws Gage out the window there, second floor window. I totally thought of The Shining with Danny and Wendy in the bathroom there. Also talking about The Shining, total, because they switched the kids, Gage totally has the shine. It reminded me so much of The Shining, because the little boy's saying, it's Pascal, Red Rum, you know, because he's the one that sees the ghost. So more Shining things, I thought of. Anyway, I wanted to get that in there before he wrapped up. So,
but he also drew the picture, right? He also drew the picture.
Right. But we had debated in the first one that we got the sense that Gage
she had
seen.
Shine.
No, that, oh, right, that Ellie did. But yeah, the picture was an extra touch that I thought was really good. Yeah.
See, and watching it the first time, I got the impression that she was lying by saying that Gage, you know, I got kids. It sounded to me like she was lying and that she actually did draw the picture. But then at the end, I'm like, no, wait. I think that it actually was Gage. And, you know, that's setting up the fact that the Pascal thing, which wasn't paid off well. So, I mean, like, there's a couple things I didn't like in this movie, but I really did enjoy the movie. I mean, it's just, it's a remake, right? They made some changes. I don't agree with every change they made. I liked some of the other ones that they did make. So, you know, I enjoyed it.
It's a remake that I think justifies its own existence. You know, if it were just a beat by beat, it would be like, why? What's the point? The fact that we're sitting here talking about these changes and they weren't just changes for change's sake, you know, because they decided to switch the kids, like we were saying earlier, it spirals the story into another path, you know, and that's cool. And I'm glad these different versions exist. That's why covers of songs are cool. That's why remakes are cool, because you get different things from different versions. The perfect version of this is probably somewhere in between both of them. But hey, I'm glad we have the choices and the variation to choose from.
John, did you have any final thoughts on the film?
I'm not trying to be like the negative guy or anything, but I didn't agree with having the Ramones song on it. As much as a part of me, you know, is like, oh, yeah, that Ramones song is just as much a part of Pet Sematary as anything else. This movie was supposedly trying to be its own thing. And by having the Ramones song, which is informed by the sensibilities of that original movie, that song belongs to those sensibilities. It doesn't belong to this one. And I thought it was a very discordant thing to put over the end credits in this case. It just didn't work after this type of movie.
Interesting. You're crazy.
Probably.
No, I thought it was a fun callback to the original movie. I mean, like, that's the extent of my thought process on it. But I know the song means a lot more to you than to me. I'm like, oh, that's cool. They even did the original song. Nice. Zach, so what are we rating this out of? I don't remember.
Well, first, Brandon, we have to have a kill count.
Yes.
So y'all have to help confirm or deny with me the the kill count here, or the death count. So the cat... One cat in church. We have. I'm not going to count the dog we see because the dog was already dead. We have Ellie. We have Rachel. We have Lewis. We have Judd. And I believe that's it. Do
Pascal.
We count Zelda? Did we count? Oh, Pascal. I'm sorry, Pascal. Did we count Zelda the first time around? I don't think we did because that was a flashback.
I don't think we did. No. We can in this one because it was on screen. So that's seven.
But it was technically on screen in the first one, wasn't it?
No, I don't think so.
No.
Well, we did, Well, you know, we will count it this time because you literally see her fall down to her death. So we will count it. So that's six people and one cat.
Did you mention Gage in that mix?
Did Gage die?
Well, did he?
I guess we didn't
see it.
No. If you piece together that opening and that ending... That kid's over.
But between the flashback death and the Gage death, do we want to just count that as one, or do we? I don't. John, you're our guest. You decide. Do we count Gage's dying?
I say that yes, Gage is dead. All right. And
John is dead set on killing this 2-year-old boy. We'll do it.
Hey.
We have seven people and one cat, which brings our grand total for the Pet Sematary franchise to 22 people. Three dogs, six cats, and countless rabbits.
Countless rabbits.
Yes.
Oh, I love that.
We're still counting the rabbits.
Clancy Brown's rabbits. So, all right, guys. Well, John, you're our guest. You'll go first. How many times would you resurrect out of five Pet Sematary 2019?
I feel like I have to duck after I say this, but 1.5.
Whoa.
1.5? Whoa! And I thought I was being negative. Goodness gracious sakes alive.
Dude, that came out of left field based on our discussion that we just had. Holy boy, I thought you enjoyed this. I thought you liked
John,
this more than that.
I don't recall, John. What did you give the first Pet Sematary?
3.5.
Three. Okay, because I gave Pet Sematary 2 1.5. Goodness gracious.
I can't remember Pet Sematary 2 what I did, but I think Pet Sematary 2 was either 1 or 1.5.
So... Yeah. You know, I said before we wrapped up here that this justified its existence. Do you feel the same way or no?
Not really, no.
Wow,
Ouch.
That, I sorry, agree with Brandon. That was an unexpected rating, John.
Holy smokes.
I'm going to give it 2.5 out of 5 resurrections. I thought it was just middle of the road. I ranked the first, just for some context, I ranked the first Pet Sematary 3 out of 5. Pet Sematary 2, 1.5 out of 5. And this one would be a 2.5 out of 5. Slightly under the first one. If I had to recommend what version someone should watch, I would still recommend the 1989 version. But again, I feel like this one did enough stuff. I mean, we were sitting here talking. Most of our conversation had been the changes and the butterfly effect of those changes in this story, in this version of the story. So, you know, that gives you food for thought, things to talk about. I think there's a perfect version of this movie somewhere in between the 1989 and the 2019. So this one's right down the middle with 2.5 out of 5 for me. What about you, Brandon?
John gave Pet Sematary 2 1 star.
I did.
And he gave this one 1.5 stars.
You know what? Because Pet Sematary 2 sucks, right? But Clancy Brown, we talked about this when we talked about it on the earlier episode. Clancy Brown, I'll come back. I would rewatch that just because Clancy Brown is so obviously he knows what he's making. And he just says, all right, fine. I'm getting a paycheck for this, so I'm just going to enjoy it. You know, so that sort of powers Pet Sematary 2 for me.
Awesome.
And this one, I just found it bland.
Well, I gave this thing 3.5 out of 5 revivals. Because, again, and that's exactly what I gave the first one. I there was a couple things I didn't like, but I did really enjoy the movie. And I would see it again, not frequently, because that killing his kid like that was pretty uncomfortable. I'm not going to lie. But I liked what they did. I thought they made some brave choices. The thing I'm mostly upset about is the freaking trailer. Honestly, I really wish they wouldn't have shown the stuff that they did in the trailer. And honestly, I'd probably give this movie a 4 if the trailer didn't ruin it for me, you know. But
I just think on the acting alone, across the board, you know, even though I prefer Fred Gwynn as Judd, I mean, all the kid acting, like Jette Lawrence, great actress. I'm going to keep my eye on her. She was at the little, because she's played such an adorable little girl before she dies and an excellent job as an undead girl. I mean, that is creepy. Yes. She's like, mommy doesn't want me here. That's okay. I don't want her here either. I'm like, oh, evil kids. So, like, I'm still getting over 1.5, John. But, okay, but hey, fair enough.
I'm not taking anything away from the skill, from the talent of these actors. I think that the direction is where things...
These people worked really hard, John. Come on.
You know what? You know who else worked really hard? Me, for the price of the ticket. Okay?
There it is.
There you go.
Oh, I have to say, this is probably my favorite episode of Franchise Fatigue, because I feel like we had a good discussion about the changes, the layers, the motivations, all this stuff. And then we get to the end here, and we're just having a good time talking about the ratings. I knew Brandon liked it a lot. This is great, John. I really enjoy podcasting with you, talking about movies. You're going to be back more often. This is great. I love it.
Thank you. I'm thrilled to be a part of it, and I'm glad that I gave everybody the surprise ending that they were looking for.
There was a better twist because the trailer didn't ruin it.
Usually I'm the negative guy around here, so I'm just shocked and delighted that I'm just middle of the road into you guys, both extremes.
There you go.
My heart's just bigger than all both of yours. I have a bigger heart.
So, now that we know our ratings, I think I know what you're both going to say. But, John, is this franchise fatigued?
Yes. Sorry.
You don't want to see Pet Sematary 2 2025?
Yeah. Pet Sematary 22. Okay, look, the title might get me in the door, but yeah, I think this franchise is fatigued.
All right, fair enough. I agree with you. I think that this is fine as a remake, but don't make any more. Just stop now. Perhaps do an alternate cut, you know, on a Blu-ray or something. That might be interesting. I'd be very interested to see an alternate version, perhaps expanded with different scenes, different endings. I'm into that kind of stuff. So I'm all for different versions of this movie, but just stop here. I think we are fatigued. Although I am more satisfied with the final product of this remake than you are, I am also going to say it is fatigued. What about you, Brandon?
Well, first, if talking about extended cuts and whatnot, I'd totally love to see the Schneider cut of this.
The Schneider cut or the Snyder cut?
The Snyder cut. Whatever the guy's name is.
The John Schneider cut.
Who's the guy that did the last one? I don't know. Zack Schneider. What's his name?
Zack Snyder. Yeah.
Snyder. I don't know. Actually, I do think that it is fatigued here, and I think they shouldn't do any more. I think the remake is good. I'm done with this. I think it's okay. I don't need to see a Pet Sematary 2 or a prequel or a remake, or I don't know. I think this is good. So
that worked out so well last time, guys. I don't know why you're so down on the idea of a sequel.
Well, I did enjoy the Pet Sematary 2. I gave it 2.5 stars. I liked it. So.
All right. Well, John, seriously, John, it's always a pleasure to podcast with you. If the listeners want to find you out there on the internet, where can they find you?
Well, right now, you'll find me mostly active over on KesselJunkie.com, where I've been writing again. You can find Kessel Junkie over on Letterboxd and Goodreads. And you can find me over on the Nerd Party Network, co-hosting two different shows. One show is called Aggressive Negotiations. It's a Star Wars podcast. We don't do any current news or anything. We do deep dive sort of philosophical takes and looks at certain things. And then I'm also co-hosting a show called Retro Perspective with Mike Schindler. And if you think that my rating of the Pet Sematary remake was harsh, then you should listen to what I had to say about Threesome, starring Stephen Baldwin, Josh Charles, and Laura Flynn Boyle, because boy, did I dislike that movie. So that's where you can find me.
You know, because you've been off of social media for the bit, you missed my tweet here. But when you and Mike were talking about that that black and white film just a little, like two episodes ago.
Suture.
I'm like, man, I totally want to see this. And you guys are all like, yeah, it's on Amazon Prime. I'm like, sweet. So I go to Amazon Prime and search it up. Like, yeah, not in Canada.
Yep. Sorry, man.
So, sucks being in Canada.
You should see it if you can.
I want to see it. You guys made it sound really good. I want to check it out. Zach, where can people find you when you're not running out in the road?
Well, you can find me on Twitter at MoronZach. That's MoronZach. I'm also the host of my own podcast, Always Sold in the Smallville. We talk about each and every episode of that Young Superman show. You can find us on Twitter at AlwaysMallville with one S. I'm also host of Standard Orbit, Trek FM's original series podcast. We're talking about all the old and new adventures of Captain Kirk and Enterprise. You can find us on Twitter at Trek FM. And of course, you can find us here on Franchise Fatigue with my friend, Brandon Shea Metella. Brandon, where can people find you?
You can find me on Twitter at Brandon Metella. Over on Trek FM, I host Melodic Treks, which is about the music of Star Trek. And I recently had Zach guest on. We talked about the music of Star Trek 3. You can find me every other week on Warp 5 with my friend Patrick, and we talk about Star Trek Enterprise. Once a month, I cover Alfred Hitchcock films on Good Evening, an Alfred Hitchcock podcast with my friends Chris and Tom. And every once in a while, I poke my head up on the Cinematic Sound Radio Network with an electronic film score podcast called Breaking the Waves. Well, next week we'll be back. Zach and I have a quick little recap episode for the Pet Sematary franchise. And the week after that, our friend Chris Tribuzio is going to join us to talk about The Godfather. So that is our next series. So be sure to stay tuned for that. But until next time, sometimes dead is better.
This has been a production of MTMR Media Works.